Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia. It is a beautiful spring day here, finally. And it is John Gresham hosting Military Monday for you. We have an interesting show today, and we're going to start off with a public service message, which I think will be of interest to many of our listeners. Many of you are familiar with the really excellent work of the nonprofit organization called Fisher House. This is an organization that builds facilities around the country so that the families of wounded warriors can live close to their loved ones while they recover and rehabilitate. And I have the pleasure of going and announcing there is going to be a fundraising event for them tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The fundraiser is being hosted by one of our listeners, Mr. Joseph Ryan, who is putting together a online, if you will, fundraising party. We are going to go and post the information for this so that you'll be able to go and attend and perhaps make a donation. The if you are interested in taking part, you can call Mr. Ryan at area code 201-841-4119, or you can email him at uubeasley@gmail.com. I see that we have Mr. Ryan on the phone, and let's have a chat with him real quick. Mr. Ryan, are you there? Hello? Hello, Mr. Ryan.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, sir. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing this for, and why did you want to do it?
Well, I always want to help the vets, especially our injured warriors. That's number one. And Deanna, who is the veterans coach on Twitter, I asked her once, what can I do to help out with the vets? And she said, you can host this party. So that's what we're doing.
And how do people, again, go and make contact so that they can attend? Please, feel free to put out your number, your URL, and your own email if you'd like, please.
Well, we finally got it set up that they can just click a link that I'm tweeting and register directly into the system, and then they'll get an email that they have to then answer, and they will be part of the party. And one thing to correct, it's not donations. There are going to be G.G. Hill items for sale. All the profits are going to go to Fisher House in by Elgin Air Force Base in Florida.
Very good. Now, is there a Fisher House there at Eglin as part of the hospital complex there, or is that something that is being worked towards?
No, there's already one there. It's an Air Force Fisher House. Each Fisher House is connected to whatever service they're closest to. There's Navy Fisher Houses, Army, Marine, and Air Force.
Very good. And what got you into doing this? I mean, what is it that has moved you to go ahead and put yourself out and to host this event?
Do anything for the military. I've been pro-military my whole life. I grew up in the Vietnam era, pretty shameful time. And my son is career Army. Deanna's family, her father is a 27-year veteran of the Air Force, served two terms in Vietnam. So she grew up in the military. She herself is a Navy veteran and a corpsman. Her brother is an Airborne Army Ranger. So we kind of got all the services covered.
So there's a lot of family connections here that are leading you towards this.
Yes, sir.
And again, can you lay out the contact information so that people can go ahead and contact you? We'll also see about posting this on the RightStream webpage that we put the archive on for this show. Please, again, sir, contact information.
First, I can't thank you and Daria enough. If anybody wants to register, the link that you can go directly to, that's a long one, but it's http://, Deanna Warwood, DeAnnaWarwood.com/blog/big-joes-benefit-bash. Wow, that's a tongue twister.
Yes, and we'll try and put that up with the archive of this after the show. And how long will this go on tomorrow night?
No more than an hour, possibly less. Power work is, I'll open it, come up with something to say, and then Deanna will take over, and she will show the line of items that are up for sale. Then the participants will get an email with an order form, so any of the items they saw that they would like to buy, they'll be able to purchase them. After they purchase them, it'll take about 2 to 3 weeks before Deanna receives a check back from GG Hill, which will be deposited into her account. Then she will write a check out and go to the Fisher House at Elgin Air Force Base and present their president with the check, and there will be pictures of that event, and they will be posted for all to see that all the proceeds went to Fisher House.
Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about this, and I really appreciate you and Deanna going and doing something positive for the Wounded Warriors. Again, I hope we can go ahead and post the information for this event on our webpage for Military Monday. And, sir, thank you for your time. I much appreciate it.
Thank you, sir, for the time. And God bless you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, and with that, we're going to go and move into the main part of our discussion today. My main guest today is, in fact, a old friend and someone who is going and continuing a line of editorial work that goes back decades. I'm talking about Mr. Eric Wertheim, who is both a consultant here in the D.C. metro area within the military business, but also is a writer and editor for the U.S. Naval Institute, the fine organization and publishing house out in Annapolis, Maryland. One of the things that USNI has gone and done for decades is they produce a single volume every couple of years called Combat Fleets of the World. And what this book quite simply does, and it's a huge thing, it's one of those books that you put on your bookshelf and you're proud to display because you take it down and use it so regularly, is that it lays out every navy in the world with every ship and aircraft and weapon system they have, and better than any other single volume guide out there, really provides readers and scholars and people who are just interested in navies with an instant source of information, details, specifications for what the navies and the warships of the world look like. And he's been doing this for over a decade, having taken over for an earlier editor and friend, Dr. A.D. Baker. And with no further ado, I'm going to go and bring on Eric. Eric, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Great to be here, John. Can you hear me okay?
I can. And how'd I do with my introduction?
Oh, it's good. It's great to know there are so many people that use combat fleets. And, of course, it's the original version traces its ancestry all the way back over 100 years to a French book, Floats de Combat, that is still published today in France. And in 1976, the first English language of the book, Combat Fleets of the World, was published by the Naval Institute. And it started as a translation, strict translation of the French edition. And after a couple years, my predecessor, Dave Baker, came into the picture, and he started making it more independent of the French version and putting his own analysis and information in there. And eventually it morphed into a very separate, distinct version with its own information and its own way of doing the analysis and giving the information on the world's navies. And now the newest edition, the 16th edition, the 16th United States edition, English language edition, is being ready to be released this spring, probably in about 2 months.
Excellent. And it's worth noting that I have, I believe, every single edition that's ever been published. It takes up several shelves on my books, on my bookshelves here at home. And let's give me some idea, how big are these books in terms of page count, size, weight, heft? I mean, talk about this thing.
Sure. This each edition is well over 1,000 pages. They are now, you know, as the world's navies increase in complexity, there's a lot more information, and a lot of the smaller navies are growing in size. So the books, each one are over 1,000 pages. They have well over 4,000 photographs. Each ship that's possible to get an illustration for, oftentimes just a drawing. If we can't get an exact photo, most of them, 90% of them actually are photos. And we have some tremendous line drawings, technical diagrams in this new edition, and each edition just keeps getting better and better. It's really exciting.
And this is not just about ships. This is also about naval aviation. It's about weapon systems. It's about the fact that there are Marine Corps around the world that many other countries have. I mean, try and give us some sense of the scope that this thing covers in terms of the entire world of maritime combat fleets.
Sure. The official title is the Naval Institute Guide to Combat Fleets of the World, Their Ships, Aircraft, and Systems. So what that means is every piece of maritime power from navies, aviation arms, coast guards, paranaval organizations, and the naval infantry forces and things like that are all included. So you take a typical force like, you know, whether it's the French or starting with anything from the French, the Chinese, the Indian navies, all the way down to smaller African and Asian navies, and I'll go through where their bases are, starting where their bases in their organization, and then I'll go into the number of personnel that are in those organizations. And then I'll go into the types of naval aviation arms they use and the type of weapons they operate. And then I start going into the ships. And each ship will be listed with displacement information, how much the ship weighs, what the dimensions are, the speed of the ship, the number of crew members, the radars and sensors and electronics, and the weapon systems on each ship. And then I give remarks about some details about the ship, you know, what the history of when the ship was ordered, and oftentimes what other navies operate similar ships, things like that. So very often each ship is accompanied by drawings and photographs so that the multi-view, the reader can get multiple views so that they can see which ship they're looking at when they're at sea or going through any kind of analysis. So it's
and
very
how
useful.
Low do you go? How low do you go? I mean, what constitutes a you know, a combat ship in your opinion?
Any ship in any navy or paranaval force in the world is included, even down to the federal police services. So I will not include state police and local law enforcement, but I will include federal law enforcement, so maritime police, that's at a federal level, and I will include border patrols and border guard organizations, things like that. So, and you know, in the countries that are covered, you name it, from Albania to Zimbabwe, you have landlocked countries like Switzerland, which have boats on lakes that they have, and you have across the full spectrum, everything from ocean-going fleets like France, United Kingdom, Italy, China, India, all the way to the smallest, as I said, you know, like Hungary and Switzerland, which you wouldn't even think would have maritime forces, but they have lakes and such to operate small craft on.
And this includes riverine forces like on the Danube and the Rhine and such.
Exactly. And, you know, that's a new addition for the United States to be with some of their naval riverine forces are included in there as well. And so riverine forces are often overlooked, and it's one of the more difficult elements to get because oftentimes people don't think of these ships as part of the Navy, part of the maritime forces. And the same goes for auxiliaries and service craft. So I have tugboats that are operated and everything you can imagine, salvage vessels, submarine rescue ships, every element you can imagine, every Navy, oftentimes down to the very smallest, some navies, you know, barges, sludge barges and water barges and everything you can imagine that keeps a Navy in service. And tracking those is a major challenge.
Excellent. And for those of you who have just joined us, this is Military Monday with John Gresham. Our guest today is Eric Wertheim. If you'd like to ask Eric or myself a question, please feel free to call area code 347-945-7246, and we'll be happy to take your questions and talk with you on the phone. Eric, obviously you've been doing this for over a decade now, correct?
Yeah, the book was turned over to me in 2002. My predecessor, Dave Baker, resigned and decided he retired. And the Naval Institute came to me and said, you know, would you be interested in doing this? And at first, it's such a massive undertaking that I have to admit I wasn't really sure that I was up to it. And we had some big talks with the publisher, and they felt very strongly that I was the right person to do it. And I got to tell you, with a project this big, it really takes some growing into. And the more you learn, you know that expression, the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And
exactly.
It's pretty amazing to see that part of my job is making sure that I'm able to identify the experts on each element of each Navy, of each ship. So, for instance, I might be the expert on the world's navies, and I'm often called that. But I have to know where to go to identify information on a specific ship, a specific missile, a specific radar, and where to go, whether it our colleagues or our industry experts or who that is to help get that information. Oftentimes, they're not always so happy to give it, but it's not like there's any sneaking around. All this stuff is from open sources. There's no information that would harm national security or things like that. It's all from open sources, and I have sources all over the world and colleagues and friends from ship repair workers to people in public affairs to shipbuilders and everywhere you can imagine. And there's also photographers all over the place, merchant mariners that travel the world and take pictures of these ships for me and send them back. And you can imagine that's one of the more fun parts of the job is going through these thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of photos that come in every year.
I'm guessing that this makes for a very, very varietal network of sources that you've built up over the years.
Yes, and they're always changing, so it's very important to keep up on where people are moving, which jobs are in now, and it's really very similar to building a private intelligence service. In the old days, you know, in World War I and before, they had the kind of technology we know today. Intelligence was done just this way, you know, by people saying, I just saw this ship leave port here. It's got a new radar on it. They'll send me a picture. I'll look at the picture, be able to figure out what kind of radar it is, and we'll make a note of that. So the next edition is going to have that information. And that's what the most fun, exciting part about each new edition is. It's got the most information, the best information. And this is the first new edition in over 5 years. It's going to be 6 years now since the last edition came out. And I'm excited for this new one.
Now, this is obviously a rather specialized book by any standard. I mean, it's not cheap. It's several hundred dollars if you're going to buy a copy of it. and therefore it obviously has to provide some value in a particular niche. Who is that niche? Who needs a copy of Combat Fleets of the World 16th edition?
Well, you'd be surprised. The list price right now is $295, but there's discounts going all the way down to $191.75 that the Naval Institute is offering for members and things like that. So, but it is an expensive book. Now, when compared to some of our competitors, there's a British edition that that some people might know of. That's a competitor of mine, and that's well over $1,000 for that.
And we're talking the classic Jane's fighting ships that's been out there for a long time as well.
Yes, exactly. And I actually cut my teeth out working on Jane's. That was my first job out of college, and I worked at Jane's for about a year. And I learned all it is and all that they are. And they're a great company, and they make great products. But what I do is every edition of mine that goes to press, I make sure that there's nothing that my competitors have that I don't. And I always make sure that what we're selling for $300 and less is at least as good as what my competitors are selling for a lot more. So that being said, then, who needs combat fleets? Well, the navies of the world, of course, are very prime users because it helps with ship recognition. It helps with knowing what's out there. That's one thing, and everything that's in there, of course, is unclassified, so no one needs to worry about that. That's the first thing.
So the data can be used for briefings, assessments, and other things on an unclassed level.
Exactly. Then, so you start with that, and then you go down to another level, which is the media. The media, of course, need to know what's going on in the world, and when a ship runs aground or is involved in any kind of enemy action or any kind of humanitarian assistance, they would like to know what information is out there, what they need. So that's automatically another set of users of the book. This is the international media. Then you go into libraries, which, of course, have an interest in keeping that. And military libraries, of course, are big users, like the Pentagon Library and the Naval Academy Library. But more so, there are libraries all around the country and the world that use this book because it's really the definitive source and the guide on the world's navies. And then you go into a level that's often overlooked and one that is very important to combat fleets, to combat fleets of the world, to the Naval Institute, and that is in some ways what we call the aficionados, the amateur users.
The enthusiasts who are naval supporters and followers.
Exactly. And those people all around the world and in the United States also are very interested in what's happening around the world, whether they be involved in shipbuilding or whether they be involved in the intel community or whatever it is. These are people that also just have an interest. And those people are a huge market for the book because there are people who enjoy reading about trains. There are people who enjoy reading about automobiles and airplanes. Well, this is the book for those people who enjoy reading about ships. There's no other book like it. There's nothing like it in the world. And it's a joy to put it together.
And putting it together obviously gives you an insight on the world's navies that must be a little like having the ability to read the pulse of the world's navies. In other words, you've obviously, had an interest in naval activities for as long as I have, going back to our youth. And this means you've watched navies grow, contract, and then grow back. What kinds of things are you seeing in terms of the growth and trends in navies today? And obviously it depends on the size of the country. It depends on their access to the sea. It depends on how much money they have. But what kinds of trends are you seeing among the various countries of the world that depend on maritime access for their economies?
It's a really unique bird's eye view that I have of the world navies because of this work. And it's a little like looking at the globe and being able to see all these trends happening. And you'll see some big trends that I see a lot are the Western countries, the NATO countries are cutting back. The North Atlantic, the Canadians, United States, French, the British, they're dealing with budget challenges and the fiscal realities that we read about every day in the news. by that same token, you have countries in Asia that are dealing with their own version of events in the news that we also see. And those countries in Asia are building up at a pace that we have not seen since the Cold War. And so countries like Japan and Korea and South Korea, I should say, and China, of course, are building up very, very much. And you have countries like the Philippines, which are in the midst of their greatest buildup in their country's history. And so they really, you know, a lot of these countries, there's a lot of power struggles going on right now in the South China Sea, and China is really pushing its weight around. And as a result, there's new alliances forming and new friendships that are forming and new ship programs that are coming to fruition to help, in some ways, speed this process up, but also that are joining the fray of these tensions. It's quite an interesting thing going on right now in Asia. It's a very tense time right now in Asia between North Korea and South Korea, of course, but also with Chinese claims in the South China Sea, where they claim really the majority of the South China Sea as sovereign Chinese territory, where if you look at the United Nations agreements, that's certainly not the case. So it puts a lot of countries in very uncomfortable and tense situations. And, of course, the defense of that is their Navy, and that's why there's such naval buildups in those areas.
How about the area of the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf? What kinds of scenes do we see there going on?
Well, certainly there's in recent years, for the past 50 years or so, there's been a lot of money in that area with the oil, and there continues to be great technological equipment purchases. So they buy the best very often. You have countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Oman. They're buying very advanced, highly technical equipment from the French and from all over. And then, you know, you have countries that, you know, India, of course, is also building up its ocean-going navy. But shifting more to the Persian Gulf, of course, you have those countries like, you know, Oman and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia that are building up. Now, of course, you have countries that don't have a great navy, like Bahrain, but they have a great presence with the United States fleet there. So you also, of course, have the, you know, elephant in the room, which is Iran. And Iran is building up tremendously. This edition of Combat Fleets will highlight the Iran Navy in a way that previous editions have not. You see by looking at Iran's Navy how much growth there has been in terms of submarine production, in terms of small boat production, and in terms of their missiles are equipping many, many of their warships. And those missiles are derived from Chinese anti-ship missiles. And they're even on the smallest of boats.
And, of course, it's not just the Iranian Navy, but, in fact, the IRGC naval component as well. They really have two navies, along with a Coast Guard, of course.
Yes, absolutely. They have their more their general-purpose navies, and then they have their what's often called the Pazderon. And that force is it's really quite interesting how it works with Iran, because the way that their fleet is organized and the way that their equipment is divided makes for some very, very interesting analysis. And the way I'll kind of explain it is, you know, the Islamic Republic of Iran Navy, which is also known as the Iranian Navy, has about 18,000 people and about 2,600 Marines. The IRGC, also called the Pazderon Revolutionary Guard, they have about 20,000 people, so it's even a little a little larger than the regular Navy, and they have about 5,000 Marines, and that's administered separately. Beginning around 2007, they had this reorganization where the Iranian Navy was given responsibility for longer-range, extended-duration operations, and the Pazderon Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy they were assigned operations and operational control inside the Persian Gulf waterway. So that's kind of how things have been developing in the Iranian Navy. And the, as you might imagine, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy is a bit more extreme and zealous in some of their work. And so
and has its own separate command and control system, obviously.
Yes, they can be a bit zealous and aggressive, more aggressive in many ways than the regular Iranian Navy. So it's quite interesting how that works, and you'll see a lot of their new equipment and the more dangerous their speedboats and things like that that are involved for operations in the Persian Gulf going to that Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy, while the bigger ships go to the regular Iranian Navy.
What, if any, developments are we seeing in Africa? And we'll obviously talk about East Africa, West Africa, and North Africa. What do you see happening there, Eric?
Well, it's interesting because many of the smaller countries around the world are looking to have their own shipbuilding capability. And surprisingly, you're even seeing this in Africa, where, for instance, Nigeria has built its first domestically designed and produced warship. It's a small warship, and you know, but it's a start for them. And I think we're going to be seeing more of that in countries where, you know, we're just talking about a 100-ton patrol ship, but it's designed and built domestically in Lagos, in Nigeria. So that's a big step for them. I think that you're seeing a lot more newer ships. There's a lot of money in certain oil-producing countries in Africa. And so you're seeing a desire to be able to protect those assets because there's a lot of natural energy piracy and things like that that's going on in these areas. So countries are trying to build up their navies. Unfortunately, there's not always a rhyme or reason about what ships they buy. So some of these countries may be buying very, very expensive large ships that cost a lot to operate, when they might really be better off with smaller ships. But it's difficult for them to make that decision sometimes, and sometimes there's corruption involved and all kinds of issues going on.
In other words, there's prestige, there's corruption, there's all of the other factors that affect real governments in these parts of the world, and it doesn't stop at the water's edge, literally or figuratively.
Exactly, and China actually is making tremendous inroads, and many of the new production ships that are going into service in these African navies are from China. And we're seeing that quite a bit, is that China is able to sell them affordable ships, and they don't necessarily need to be highly advanced, but they're pretty big ships, and we're seeing that quite a bit now in countries all around, whether it's Namibia, which has bought a 2,500-ton patrol ship named the Elephant from China, and is now in service, 108 meters. It's a really large ship for an African country. You see that kind of situation happening a lot more, that China is becoming very involved in exporting their ships.
What do you see up in North Africa these days?
Well, it's Algeria is really the largest defense budget in Africa. It's really their defense growth is expected to grow continuously for quite a long time, for quite a bit. Their acquisition plans right now include new submarines, frigates, corvettes. So Algeria is really a powerhouse right now. In 2012, their government announced plans to buy as many as four new frigates from Germany. Two of those frigates are to actually be built in Algeria. Then you have countries like Libya, which is just starting to rebuild and is looking mostly to France for small boats and things like that as they look to rebuild their navy. It's very difficult to tell what's still in service in a country like Libya. So, and of course, shifting. My guess is you're going to want to shift next to East Africa,
mm-hmm.
off the coast of Somalia. And we've actually seen some success off the coast of Somalia in the counter-piracy operations. Somali maritime piracy has actually declined significantly in the past year. This past October, actually, a report by the International Maritime Bureau talked about this dramatic drop. And some of the most impressive numbers were that in July through September 2012, there were 36 piracy incidents off the coast of Somalia. That conflicts with, in July through September of 2012, there was just one, whereas in 2011, that same time, we saw 36. That's a tremendous drop.
I was reading just last night that in the year, the whole of 2012, there were only 25 seizures as compared to, well, close to 100 the previous year.
Yes, and I think that speaks to a lot of things. That it indicates that the naval coalitions operating in that area really appear to be working, so that's a really good news story. And other measures as well have contributed to this success, to cut piracy. There's efforts on the ground, establishing more structured and layered defenses for the ships traveling in the area. Those are really important things to remember. And, of course, moving south now in Africa, South Africa actually has been seeing some small budget increases in their Navy. They have a couple of new, very important programs to help bring their Navy into the future. They have some new offshore patrol ship programs, auxiliaries, some service craft that are looking to enter service, but they just finished a major advances in their Navy. They now have very new frigates and new submarines that are in service, that entered service within the past few years, and they seem to be pretty happy with those ships.
What about the Europeans? What do we see out of our NATO allies these days?
Well, as I said, there's a lot of budget cuts, and that's one of the most difficult challenges they're facing. But at the same time, many of these countries are really working to do more with less, and their equipment is kind of too double-tiered. They're having a few very, very highly technical ships, such as the Dutch have very, very good class of frigates that are very good air defense ships and really high tech. And then they're building lower tech, less expensive offshore patrol ships. And that's, we're seeing that very frequently that's happening, is they have like a high-low mix that we're seeing with the navies.
Much like Elmo Zumwalt called for in the 60s and 70s, yes.
Yes, and the only difference is that those ships in some ways were smaller in size, and these ships are long range, so they're pretty big oftentimes, because the steel is not the expensive part, it's the electronics and the weapon systems. So by building a big ship, it's not as expensive as building a big ship with all those weapons. And so that's really what we're seeing. And so Denmark, for instance, has some very new, very advanced frigates, and you see France has really in the past decade changed the whole they've really fixed a real capability gap of air defense that they used to have, and they have some very, very successful destroyers. The Forbin class of destroyers is they have two of them, and it's very, very good. And you know, it's interesting, I'm often asked which country is the most powerful navy, which is the best navy, which is the biggest navy, and what I try and do is look in terms of capabilities, and I try and say, if an emergency happens anywhere in the world, how is that Navy able to respond? The truth is that in terms of that question, if some of their forces are kidnapped, or if a ship is seized, or if there is some way that needs to be power, where power, national power needs to be projected from the sea, which countries are able to do that? And in terms of that, there are remarkably few navies that can do that. Of course, the United States can do that. But one of the countries that might surprise a lot of people is that France is very, very capable of – they have a very well-balanced fleet of ships. They have aircraft carrier, and they're planning on building a second aircraft carrier, a large deck aircraft carrier that they have already. And they have some very good fighters and aircraft on that. And then you look at their air defense ships, as I said, the Forbin class, and now they have a new class of frigates. So that's been very, very successful. They had some gaps about 10 years ago. Now, on the other side of the coin is the British Navy. The British Navy is suffering right now. They have no aircraft carriers anymore. They have two large aircraft carriers under construction, but they're in a bit of a momentary pause right now. To save money, they have turned their main aircraft carrier, which was the Illustrious class, the Invincible class, there's only one left in service, HMS Illustrious, and that has been turned into an amphibious assault ship. So it no longer operates fixed-wing aircraft. All of their Navy's fixed-wing aircraft, the Harriers that became so famous in the Falklands War, they've all been retired. Most of them have been purchased by the United States Marine Corps, actually, to use as spare parts and things like that. But until the Joint Strike Fighter comes in and until Britain's new aircraft carriers come in, the British do not have much of a naval aviation arm, only helicopters.
And what are our Russian friends doing?
That's very, very interesting. The Russians have long desired, since the end of the Cold War, to come back in power. Their Navy is a key element of that power, of that national power, and they hope to play an increasing role in the Eastern Indian Ocean, the Western Pacific, the South China Sea, the Arctic. But these things cost money. And there's a lot of promises that are made by politicians, one of which is that leadership has spelled out their desire to replace 70% of their equipment with modern weapons by 2020. That's a really big challenge. 2020 is not that far away to replace 70% of their aging equipment. I don't think it's going to come anywhere near that. Those goals sometimes, they tie things up, and it's very difficult to know which ones are realistic and which ones are not. We do know, though, that their strategic nuclear forces remain their country's highest priority. That being said, 8 new ballistic missile submarines are planned for service by the 2020s. Those are going to be the Bori class. And they're also producing new attack submarines and things like that. It's important to remember that Russian arms exports are a huge part of their economy. And so because of that, they're very much interested in selling abroad. And they're selling to countries like Vietnam, which is extremely concerned about growing Chinese power in the South China Sea, as we discussed before. So you see a lot of that.
And finally, let's come into the Western Hemisphere and let's talk a little bit about Latin America. What do we see down in Latin America? Because at the moment, Latin America has had this outbreak of peace and there are no peer competitors trying to rattle their sabers at each other. So what do we see in terms of naval developments in the Caribbean and the Southern Atlantic and Pacific?
Well, there's still these other issues in terms of Hugo Chavez may be gone, but we're not sure what's going to happen with the Navy he built. Venezuela, they have 4 new patrol ships that are entering service, and they have a lot of new patrol ships and vessels that are entering service being built in Cuba and in Europe. So we see that. We see that Colombia recently has commissioned 2 retired German submarines. So Colombia has now received 2 additional submarines to join its existing submarine fleet. We're seeing that Chile is buying new offshore patrol vessels, and so they are looking to build some ships. And the important thing about these offshore patrol vessels, as I said, they're not necessarily highly technical or very heavily armed, but they're long range and they're very stable in rough seas, and those are able to help, a lot of them are able to help even with light ice breaking, Arctic operations, things like that. And you see,
and of course they're doing fisheries protection, they're doing monitoring of offshore mineral exploration, things of that sort, right?
Exactly. That's exactly what these ships are used for. You know, when you think offshore patrol, it's offshore protection of these assets. And that's really what they're doing. Then you have countries like Ecuador, which is looking to acquire more maritime patrol aircraft, helicopters. Mexico has its own unique problems because of the drug war, but it's not completely unique. But their Marine Corps is playing a very, very important role in that counter-drug operations. And it's very difficult for their government to know where corruption is present and being able to do that. The Marine Corps seems to be very loyal and being able to take that fight to the drug lords. They have some bigger ships that are new patrol ships that are entering service, new patrol aircraft and things like that. But, of course, their Navy is not a huge priority because of these major challenges they're facing. Peru is modernizing. You know, they're looking at Peru's actually got a sizable Navy, and they're looking at new logistics support ships, patrol ships, even a sail training ship. And, you know, it's not a big area, but prestige also plays a very important role in terms of navies and what these countries are buying. And so a lot of these countries are looking to buy ships. They're looking at secondhand ships, offshore patrol ships, new build ships, all kinds of stuff. And Latin America, there are some countries that have money to spend on this stuff, but we don't know from year to year if that money is going to stay stable enough to buy a fleet of ships.
And last but not least, the United States Navy. What is, you know, you see it all. What is the current state of the U.S. Navy in your mind?
Well, the budgets, as we all know, have been hitting it very hard. They're really attempting to brace itself for these defense cuts, and there's almost no way. Everything is so unpredictable. You know, in early 2013, the Navy restructured and reduced its force structure requirement. They used to have a plan that said, in the future, we want to have a fleet of 313 ships. They realized this is just not going to be possible anymore. They reduced it to 306. It's not a big drop, but I think it's finally an admission of defeat that they're not going to be able to reach those numbers. They're shifting their forces from the Atlantic to the Pacific in line with this greater focus on Asia, which I think is important. Most things are already in Asia right now. We're actually sending more over there. The U.S. Navy lost a battle-hardened veteran with the retirement of the Enterprise this past year. In December 2012, you know, one of the most decorated ships retired. It was the world's first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the Navy's oldest aircraft carrier.
A ship the American taxpayers got every dime's worth of value out of and then some in many ways.
Exactly, and they transferred that storied Enterprise name to the new Gerald Ford-class aircraft carrier CVN-80. So when that ship is built, it will likely be named USS Enterprise, although there are some doubters because besides the fact that these carriers are tremendously expensive, well over $10 billion, the challenge has been if you don't name it, these ships for a person, they risk not being funded. So that's some argue with that fact. So you have, you know, the Gerald Ford class, you have a lot of these names increasingly, and unfortunately some argue, are being named for people, which politicizes the process. Although that's always been an issue throughout naval history. So
exactly. And of course, it's not just the carriers that we're drawing down on, but we're also drawing down in other places. We lost to a very, very bad accident a very valuable minesweeper on a reef out in the Philippines, and we're retiring hand over fist the old Oliver Hazard Perry guided missile frigates known as FIG-7s. I mean, just in the last week, we retired three of those. So we're seeing a lot of bottom line low-end retirements as well.
Yes, and unfortunately, those frigates are being retired without replacements, and as are the mine countermeasure ships, because the littoral combat ships, which are entering service, are not yet capable of conducting the mine countermeasures at the level that a mine countermeasure ship would. And the frigates were really multi-purpose ships that, in their prime, were able to conduct low to mid-level air defense, anti-surface, and just general purpose duties. And while the littoral combat ships in some ways were designed to be replacements, they're not really the equivalent. So what I think is happening is we're seeing this new fleet of littoral combat ships and the two classes of these littoral combat ships being re-examined. Because originally there were 55 that were going to be purchased. Now that number has dropped to 52. And my guess is it could drop even lower as they look at alternatives and the possibility perhaps even of buying a new frigate design. We'll have to wait and see what happens with this replacement. But, you know, it's a big question because I'm not sure that LCS really answers the mail on replacing these ships that are being retired.
Yep, and so that's what the fleets of the world look like. Now, here's the question. How are those fleets relevant to the emerging and now rather simmering crises that we have around the world? Let's start with the Korean Peninsula. What do navies do to influence events onshore, particularly in the mind of Kim Jong-un, who is not believed to be the most stable of personalities?
Well, that's the good point. And I think that brings me to the two areas I wanted to be able to, I didn't get a chance to touch on, which is submarines and ballistic missile defense. And so the United States Navy is at the forefront of the ballistic missile defense mission, which is protecting ourselves and our allies from enemy ballistic missiles that can be shot our way. It's a very, very technically challenging process and to develop these systems. And one of the benefits of a Navy is you can put these missiles and these systems on ships, and you can base them near our allies, and they provide presence and protection for those forces. That's a really important element of naval power, is being able to project power and protect our allies. It's a show of force, a calming effect for our friends, and a realization that our enemies are not going to be able to get away with what they might want to. And so,
In other words, anything up to the 50-fathom line in terms of depth, and we can take those ships and subs and operate them right up to that.
Yes, and there are presence that's seen, that everyone knows is there. Then on the flip side of that, you have submarines, which are a power without being seen. They stay hidden. They can strike targets over 1,000 miles away with Tomahawk cruise missiles. And they are able to take out enemy vessels, and they're able to take out other submarines and protect waterways and lay mines, deploy special operations troops, and more, perhaps according in peacetime, among the most important, is collect intelligence. Collect information so that we can make the best decisions based on what's happening. There's all kinds of things that submarines can do, but because we don't see them in the news every day, we don't think about it. Submarines play a very, very important role in Asia because oftentimes in very highly tense warfighting environments, surface ships have their own vulnerabilities. And submarines are often the only ship that can go into a high-threat environment and survive oftentimes, unless we're talking about the most capable of surface warships, and there just are not so many of those to go around.
And, of course, an American or French or British nuclear submarine can become the boogeyman in an instant, as was seen down in the Falklands back in 1982.
Yes, no one knows where it is. And, you know, we also should not forget, though, that North Korea has its own submarine capability. They're not nuclear submarines, but they're not nuclear-powered submarines. But we did see a couple of years ago, North Korea torpedoed a South Korean ship with no warning, sunk the ship, and killed dozens of South Korean sailors in what many countries would see is an act of war. Of course, they are technically still at war, but it is remarkable to see the actions that the North Koreans have done using their navies. And hopefully, when navies are on higher alert, those things don't happen. But it shows the power of navies to be able to affect world events.
And with that said, let's shuffle down the China coast to the South China Sea, where there is basically a whole bunch of countries with a whole bunch of weeds up their backside regarding resources and control of the maritime lanes down there. Please talk about that.
It's a pretty crazy environment right now in the South China Sea because you have, for instance, as I mentioned before, the Philippines are in the midst of what's their largest military modernization program in the country's history. Tensions are high. For instance, in 2013, early this year, China occupied contested waters in the Scarborough Shoal off the Philippine coast in the South China Sea. The Philippines can't really do much because the Chinese Navy and maritime security forces are really throwing their weight around. And there's not many options other than an all-out conflict. They're pretty much occupying land that is contested and thumbing their nose at anyone who says there's no right to do this. So,
none of China's competitors really are up to snuff in terms of firepower, sensors, and other systems they can back it up with, obviously.
Well, the smaller navies, like the Philippines and Vietnam, are not. They're trying to build up. But the larger countries, like Japan, are able to. But Japan has a very, very capable navy, among the best in the world. But the challenge is really political there. Do they want to fire back and destroy a Chinese ship when China is really throwing its weight around these contested waterways? And so that kind of challenge, Japan's Maritime Self-Defense Force, their Coast Guard, they're strengthening their own ties with traditional allies, U.S., Australia. They're also even looking to India as a counterweight. Last year marked the first Japanese-Indian maritime exercises between the Japanese and Indian navies, which was a real sign of what China is, their actions are doing to push other countries together. I'm not always sure that they realize what they're doing, but I think in terms of being able to do what they feel is standing up for their rights are really pushing other countries that might not have had any common bond together. Japan is really building up their forces, and we're seeing that. Malaysia, for instance, is really – they're trying to walk a middle ground, and they try to mediate and things like that because they're not in a very strong position. They kind of are stuck in the middle of all this. But they realize that sovereignty, their own sovereignty and security in, for instance, the Straits of Malacca are really a big concern for them. So they're buying new ships as well. I think these things are important to look at. And, of course, you see countries like Australia and New Zealand, which are dealing with their own challenges. They're trying to build up forces, their own, to keep their forces stable, but there's not really much money to do it. And so you see that Australia, for instance, has some really big plans for 12 new submarines that they'd like to have in service and new air warfare destroyers that they're building. But there's real financial challenges to meeting these goals.
How about containment of Iran? What do naval forces contribute to the effort to contain they and their nuclear program these days?
Well, there's a lot of things that happen that we have to think about. Iran's Navy and its Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy, they've been really active this past year. They've been conducting exercises. They've been testifying weapons. They're preparing new ships and submarines, and there's a lot of bluster. So it's very difficult to figure out what exactly they're doing. They might announce the commissioning of a ship three times, the first time when it's laid down, the second time when it's launched, third time when it enters service. They might keep doing it. So it's hard to track which one they're talking about, and it turns out oftentimes it's the same ship they've been talking about. They also have been traveling to through the Suez Canal to Tartus, Syria. That's in early 2012. They marked it only the second time they did that since the 1979 Iranian Revolution. So they're looking to build their own weapons, their own stuff, and naval forces help monitor this, help us collect intelligence, and help us be prepared to take the fight to the enemy if we need to. Naval forces have this power to apply force from the sea. They're right there. They're a presence to deter. And as needed, they are a force to defeat in terms of launching cruise missiles, launching aircraft from the decks of flat tops, and taking down any kind of air defense aircraft that might fly towards our equipment and our friends.
And then finally, let's slide up through the Suez Canal and talk a little bit about continuing operations in the Eastern Mediterranean, running from obviously from North Africa up, of course, to Libya and from North Africa, Libya, Egypt, and then up to Syria. What's going on with the navies of the world there? Because it's getting a little crowded in the Eastern Med right now.
Yeah, well, we did talk already about North Africa, and I will talk a little about Egypt. You know, Egypt is an interesting case because we have so much money going to the Indian to the Egyptian defense budget, helping them pay for their equipment and things. So the U.S. Navy, the U.S. military, and the U.S. government supplies a lot of their funding for that. They're due to receive four new guided missile patrol ships during the next few years, and they really do hope also to purchase new submarines. But there's so much political turmoil in there, it's hard to imagine the political will to do that. You look across at Israel, and Israel is really starting to take its Navy even more seriously. You might remember that a couple years ago, an Israeli ship was attacked during the operations in Lebanon, and by an anti-ship missile launched by terrorists, and that was kind of a wake-up call that things need to be done differently, I think, for Israel. The first new batch of their submarines, they have a new class of submarines entering service. This first new batch was launched in February of 2012. And they're really getting prepared to enter service. These submarines are lengthened versions of the submarines they have, and they have air-independent propulsion, which means they're not nuclear-powered, but they can stay underwater for very, very long periods of time because they don't need to snorkel and to get that air in their engines. It makes them very, very hard to detect. They have new submarines entering service, and they're looking for new corvette-sized ships, smaller than frigate, to help protect their offshore gas production. They're even talking about putting some weapon systems on those oil facilities, such as a phalanx, to help a close-in weapon system to help defeat potential terrorists. So we're seeing that. Israel's big on unmanned aircraft, unmanned surface vessels, so they are buying a lot of that stuff. Morocco is also investing heavily. They have a lot of ships that are bought from Dutch shipyards Damen, and they are buying a lot of ships, and they have a lot of new ships entering service now from based on the Sigma design, which is a type of ship that the Dutch design. They also have a new French destroyer, a new French frigate entering service. So that's another bonus there for, you know, there's a lot of North Africa's a busy place, as you said.
And, of course, there's the quagmire and festering wound that is Syria. I mean, the Russians have squadrons there. NATO has squadrons off the coast. We'd stick our nose in from time to time. The Israelis are sticking their nose up there. Who's doing the traffic control off of Latakia?
It's a very good question. Essentially, Syria's civil war has really halted all normal naval activities for the country. But that port at Tartus really remains very important for the Assad regime and, of course, its Russian allies. So it's very important. Russian ships paid a couple of visits to that port at Tartus and in the past year. They reportedly have halted their arms shipments there, but it's very difficult to tell. Russian arms transferred to that region and to Syria were quite high, and some of their anti-ship missile coastal defense systems that they had exported to Syria were very, very capable. So we're not exactly sure what's become of them, though.
And with that somewhat grim look at the world of naval affairs these days, let's go back to combat fleets, because I'd like to give you a few minutes to talk about the process of what it is to build this monster book. And trust me, how much does it weigh?
That's a very good question. I always joke that the books are so big you could strap them on tanks and use them as extra armor. And one time, there was actually a comic strip that I was reading, and someone sent me with a cutout, and they had different ways that people were killed in the comic strip, and a big stack of Combat Fleet's books fell on one of the suspects. So they told me that was the unique way of killing a bad guy, to have a big stack of Combat Fleet's fall on, which I thought was very funny.
I've always wondered why some enterprising Naval Institute member has not offered to go ahead and produce, like, special stands or tables like they used to have for the big Bibles in the Middle Ages, just so you could actually read and use your combat fleets or your ships and aircraft of the U.S. fleet.
Yeah, it could put your foot to sleep if you put it on your lap. It's a big book. But that's the joy of it, is it's a book that you can sit through and look through for hours. And you go from, you know, with the internet, it's you jump around the internet clicking on link to link. It's a little like that with this book. You go through and you start and you find an entry in one place, and then you go to the to another entry, and you see and you compare and contrast the types of ships and the types of weapons and the types of systems, all that kind of stuff. It's really fun. And the way the process starts is that I start with the last edition of the book. And it might not seem like there's a lot of changes, but you would be surprised every single day what's going on in the world's navies. And so every little change, be it a radar, a new missile system, a new upgrade, I have to monitor the types of arms sales that are taking place and the types of shipbuilding contracts and all kinds of stuff. Oftentimes it's done by photographs that start coming through my email. And if listeners would like to send any kind of correspondence, they're welcome to do so. They can send an email to combatfleets, combatfleets, at yahoo.com, or they can fax news in if they like to do that at 703-644-9653. They're welcome to fax it. Or they can contact the Naval Institute. The U.S. Naval Institute can be reached at www.usni.org or just www.navalinstitute.org. And all those places, they can send a letter through there to the editor of Combat Fleets, me, and that's how information comes to me. Whether it's photographs or news or any type of thing like that, it's a little bit like being the pointy end of a huge intelligence collection process. And it all comes to me, and the difficult part for me is sorting through it all, because I'm like the bottom of the sieve, and all this information is coming, and I'm only one person. And while I do have research assistants from time to time, it's extremely time-consuming, but it's also a passion. So that information then comes in, and I start keeping, and I keep everything up to date. When it's time, when I work with a publisher and we decide, you know what, things are selling out, it's time for a new edition of the book, I sign the contract, and then the real work starts. And what that includes is I start with eight chapters, and every single element of every single navy gets verified, gets updated, new photographs go in to replace the old ones, and every single change that I have tracked during the time then gets put in there, all the weapons updates, all that kind of stuff. And you would be surprised how much in a couple years things change.
We talking like thousands of changes between editions?
Yes, there's no doubt thousands, tens of thousands of pages, tens of thousands of changes. So that we're talking about every single page has dozens, if not more, scores of changes. So that each entry has to be verified and updated. And then new photos have to be checked to make sure that the systems that I list are still operational on that ship. And that it's very, very time consuming, but it's really something that's a labor of love for me. And it helps me get this grounding and understanding of what's going on in the world navies as I'm tracking this. And all these 4,000 new photos have to be put in this book and properly aligned. And when you think about it, it's not just updating the book and putting the photos in. I have to work with the publisher to make sure that the photos go in the right places and to make sure that the names of the ships are spelled properly and that the photos are viewable and easy to understand. And I have to get artists. I work with artists and engineers to be able to help get the correct specs for the technical drawings. which are multi-view drawings often that show each different angle of the ship that might be of use. Sometimes stern views and front-facing views, overhead views, all different kinds of stuff. It's a very exhausting process. It takes from the time I sign a contract till the time the book comes out is usually about 2 to 3 years. So 2.5 years is generally about what this last edition took.
What kind of databasing are you using? I mean, do you have an online way to store the records for each of the warship classes and weapons types, or do you use a card file? What is the method of organizing all this before you start porting it into the book, per se?
Well, I wish I could say it was very organized, and some parts of it are very organized, but some of it, out of necessity, can be ad hoc in that I might be somewhere, get a bit of news, write it down somewhere, even send a note to myself on my cell phone, come back, and I will then put it a note on my computer, whether it's in a Word file, or actually I keep an old copy of the previous edition. Oftentimes I write notes in there so that I know what to change. And as things come together, I start doing that. I clip articles and things like that. I save a lot of articles. Of course, the internet is invaluable, as is email, because the information will start coming in. The difficulty, the challenge with the internet, as we all know, is there's a lot of information. It's almost impossible in first glance to know what's accurate and what's not. And that's really my job with Combat Fleets, is to be able to take that information that's available to everyone and figure out which is the accurate one and which is the guess, which is a Photoshopped picture of a new Chinese ship and which is the actual picture. That kind of stuff can take everything from a few minutes to weeks of analysis to work on.
Excellent. And you're due to bring out the next edition sometime here in the next couple of months, you think?
It's going to be out by June. We know it's in the springtime. We're finishing the very last page proofs, the last edits, and making sure the newest photos are in there. And it's going to probably go to press within the next month. So we're really, really getting close. So.
And much like the question of who's on every year's edition of the swimsuit edition for Sports Illustrated, what warships will be on the cover of this year's 16th edition of Combat Fleets of the World?
Well, this 16th edition is going to have an Arleigh Burke class destroyer on the cover. It's really a World Navy's focus. So right behind it is a Singapore destroyer, a frigate from the Singapore Navy, followed by that a Coast Guard ship, and then a small Asian patrol boat from, I believe, Malaysia. It's this great picture. You can go online to combatfleets.com and check it out. It's the black edition. The red edition was the last edition, the 15th edition, and now the new black edition is coming out very soon, and you can go to combatfleets.com and check it out.
I'm definitely going to have to go to IKEA to get another bookshelf, aren't I?
Yeah, they definitely have a tendency to warp and bend under the weight of a book like that.
Eric, good luck with this edition. I know that it's going to be another great, great edition because you and Dave Baker have just made this thing an institution within the publishing industry. Thank you for your time, and I hope we get to have you back on sometime soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, John. Great to be here.
Thank you very much. And that wraps up another edition of Military Monday. Please look for the archive of this show, so that you can listen to it again if you'd like, pass it along. Or if you're interested in the Fisher House online event tomorrow, we should have information that will provide contacts for you being able to go ahead and go online and purchase one of the things for sale there. It's time for us to leave. Thank you again, and I'll see you next week on Military Monday. Bye-bye.